Welcome everyone to the first podcast, maybe the second, of Coffee Over Data. Coffee Over Data is a small project we have going on at the ComDev Master Group. It's a 1-2 month project where we engage with blogs and social media as a whole from the standpoint of data and identification, whether it's good or bad. And well, if you are interested, then I suggest you check our blog. Now, today we have a guest, Axel Hessen-Tayari. He's a PhD student and junior narrative designer. Full disclosure, he's my partner, which is why I could score this interview so easily. However, also full disclosure, the questions are completely unbiased. He has not had any influence. He just could have a read over once, a bit before this interview happened, to have a clue about what I was going to ask. So, Axel, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, you're a PhD student. And I think you're dealing with hypertexts.
Yeah, I am.
For the uninitiated, what are hypertexts?
That's a good question. I don't think we have a clear idea of what they are. Broadly speaking, a hypertext is a piece of text that you can navigate in a non-linear way. So a good example might be something like Wikipedia, where different fragments of text are connected by links. And the order in which you traverse those links and the pages and the chunks of text is kind of up to you.
I see. So it is a heaven for ADHD people.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay,
yeah,
good, yeah. Good. So in the sense that you can traverse them more or less however the reader wants, within some limitations, would you say video games are a sort of hypertext?
Yeah, I would say so. Some of them more explicitly than others. Things like interactive fiction, which is mostly text-based, and people who aren't familiar with that may think of choose your own adventure books, which are fairly well known. Or dialogue choices in many games that lead to different outcomes and different branches. Yeah, those are pretty hypertextual in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say so. It just depends how they do it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess if you're a bit more on rails, it's less hypertexty.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's always some what people tend to call a possibility space.
Mm-hmm.
Within games where you have the opportunity to move about the game space in unique ways. That's one of our cats making noise.
Yes.
So if you're playing a shooter and you have to get through the end of, from one end of the level to another, I would struggle to call that hypertextual.
Yeah.
You just have some agency in how you move and carry out actions in the game world.
Okay. Now, we did get a very unrelated question in a way, because it does not really have to do exactly with the topic of the podcast. But we got the question of what is exactly a narrative designer?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like hypertext, we don't have an answer for that, which is a great thing to be in, because you can be hired as a narrative designer and not be sure what it is that will be asked of you. So, very broadly, your narrative designer is there to champion or worry about the narrative in games. What does narrative mean? Who knows? There's a prominent narrative designer whose name escapes me, who introduces himself by saying, "Hi, I'm a narrative designer, whatever that is." So, okay, some narrative designers will worry about plot and sort of the story level stuff, like a screenwriter almost. Others will be more focused on systems. So how do we use the rules of this game to tell compelling stories? How does the cooking mechanics, you know, say something about the world? And others will be more like game writers. They'll just write great dialogue. Those are all different skill sets.
I see. So in a way, a narrative designer tries to make sure that a player can be properly immersed in the world of the video game.
I would say so, yeah. And that means working with a bunch of different departments. Like, the narrative designer will probably talk to the coders as much as the visual arts folks, as much as the voice acting. Because It's about bringing those disparate elements together and hopefully make something that all works together.
Yeah. Well, okay, speaking of video games, I know that you love video games. You have a complicated relationship. How did you first get into gaming?
I was living with my older sister at the time. I was 5 years old, something like that. And her boyfriend had the very first Nintendo, the NES. And he worked in restaurants, worked long hours, which means that when I got home from school, I could secretly play the console. And that's how I got it. I discovered Mario and that annoying as fuck Duck Hunt game. And then it went on from there. Video games were I wasn't raised in a home where we read books.
Mm-hmm.
So video games alongside with comic books and hip-hop were really the only media and sort of cultural artifacts that felt accessible.
That's understandable. Do you think the characters and stories in those video games help shape your worldview? And if so, do you think that this is a common occurrence?
Yeah, I would say they do. Not to the extent of the, you know, sort of moral panics over Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
Or
you're going to go around shooting everyone.
Exactly,
yeah.
The Columbine shooting. Because they were playing Doom and listening to heavy metal. Not in that sense. But of course, they do. Games, like any piece of media, any piece of art, will radiate and articulate certain sets of ideologies.
Yeah.
And if you're repeatedly exposed to those ideologies or those messages, then certainly you will internalize some things. So yeah, I see them as inherently political, and by extent that they will shape how you view the world. And I do think this is common and inevitable.
Yeah.
I think there is a reason why certain governmental agencies have had full-on programs funding video game studios.
Yeah.
And war games in particular.
Now, you just mentioned, I think, a code phrase that got my spidey senses tingling. You say that video games are inherently political. There's a studio or two, at least, generally from AAA studios. For those not in the know, AAA studios in video games are the large studios, such as Nintendo. Nintendo would be a very known AAA studio, but it's just one of many. However, many AAA video game studios have mentioned at some point that their games are not political. What do you have to say to something like this, to a statement like this?
I think it's ridiculous and they know it, and that statement is marketing. That's what it is. It is PR. By and large. I do think some designers believe that.
Mm.
I just don't know that. I think the conversation around this is very flawed because it mixes in marketing, design views about what video games are and what people understand as political. So for it seems that for a lot of gamers, a game is political if it, let's say, mentions a current president.
I see.
Or, but then suddenly it also becomes political if it allows you to choose your gender pronouns. So there is no stable definition. I will say that the statements from those studios are ridiculous and they know what they're doing. The biggest offender might be something like Ubisoft, who made a series called Tom Clancy's The Division, based on Tom Clancy's novels. And briefly put, you know, the second game involves you playing an agent of a secret paramilitary organization during a civil war in the United States, and your base of operations is the White House. But that is not political, according to Ubisoft.
I see. So you mentioned that video games are political. Do you think, or would you say, that media in general is political?
Of course, yeah, yeah.
And, in which sense? Is it because of the way it shapes our worldview? Is it because, in a way, directly or indirectly tells its audience what they should believe or think? In which sense? I guess I'm trying to understand.
All of that.
All of that.
No, it boils down to, for me, it's Stuart Hall talking about encoding and decoding, where certain worldviews are woven into a media artifact. So when you code or paint or write about the world, you will inevitably include some biases, some assumptions, some beliefs about how you view the world. And then that goes right into the quote-unquote product. And when people process it in return, well, they will be exposed to those views.
Yeah.
So I mean it in that way. And then there's different layers of what is political about it.
Yeah. So media, even though it is portrayed as some people are the creators and other people the receivers, it's a bit more interactive than that.
Yeah, I would certainly say so. And I think the idea that media isn't political or couldn't affect us in a strong way is kind of silly when we think about the fact that it's perfectly normal to cry or laugh while watching a movie. Or to be very affected by it. So clearly, a whole set of emotions and beliefs are radiated from what you're engaging with. Why would the political or structural organizations of society be any different?
Those are very good points. Speaking of politics and media, particularly video games. I know that you're a fairly active leftist, or at least you're a vocal one. Does this shape the way you interact with video games? Or maybe the kinds of stories you prefer to both play and write?
Yeah, inevitably. It makes me very critical of things like labor conditions in the industry and how games are produced. But also, you know, if I know a studio made their employees crunch, which is to say work overtime a lot for sustained periods of time, I'm way less likely to support them, or I will be critical. Or if I know that there has been rampant cases of sexual harassment, abuse,
Blizzard,
and Ubisoft, and all of them, and indie studios as well.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily make me critique the games they put out in different ways, but it colors my approach.
Yeah.
And for the games themselves, yeah, definitely. There's been a long history of war games or even role-playing games, providing people of color or marginalized groups as part of a shooting gallery.
Yes.
Or something to get experience from so that you, the hero, can become more powerful.
Yes.
So, yeah, that does shape my views. And beyond that, the stories I prefer are not necessarily leftist stories at all, but they have to wrestle with themes that I found interesting. But yeah, I definitely wouldn't play a generic, like Call of Duty isn't for me. You know, I would play it to critique it, but a generic American shooter that sends you to the Middle East or, you know, makes Russia the enemy again and so on. Well, I find it boring.
Yeah. I guess here is where we should mention that you're French Tunisian.
Mm-hmm.
So that's understandable. And do you think that maybe this is one of the reasons why certain segments of the gaming community react so strongly when, say, the lead character in a shooter happens to be a female, or for some reason it's a story has a non-binary character or a trans character or someone who is of color? Because I do recall with a certain upcoming game which looks both futuristic and Wild Westy, the main character is a woman. And, well, this is in a sort of post-apocalyptic world. So she has no makeup. Her hair is up in dreads. She's a white woman, but okay. So she still does not come across as very feminine, you know, not very girly in that sense. And I do recall that there were a couple of Twitter posts where the players were complaining that she was not attractive enough, and where some went as far as creating sketches where somehow she had makeup.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know how she could have makeup in this post-apocalyptic world where she was trying to even get food, but still, she had makeup. So do you think that the way we interact with media and our own belief system is what creates those very strong reactions?
Yeah, 100%. I think, look, a lot of those views are shaped by marketing, and which is to say, a very specifically capitalist view of how we approach games. So we look in the case of the game you're talking about, which I think is Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yes.
First and foremost, the people who will complain about that character not being quote unquote sexy enough are often the same people who claim that games are just games and not political. So that's super interesting to me.
Yeah.
That's very hypocritical. If we're not supposed to respond to games that way, then why are you responding to it? I think we have generally, very broadly speaking, we are bombarded with messages that make us interact in very unhealthy ways with media. This is true of the Marvel franchise. This is true of a good deal of fandom where we want content tailored for us. And if it diverges from that, then people get mad.
I see. So this subset, I guess, of the gaming community want basically treat video games and the characters in them as flat objects, you would say?
I would say yes, as something that, I guess you could say flat objects, something that will not challenge or depart from their worldviews.
I see. Do you think that maybe in some of these interactions with this fictionalized, at least at some point, views of the world, does this translate to the way they treat people out in the world? So say these players who are complaining that this lead character is not sexy enough, they will, for some reason, want women to adhere to specific standards. And if so, how is that, roughly, how is that translation made, do you think? I know it's a complex question.
That's a big one, huh? If I had an answer, I think there would be grant offers thrown my way. But yeah, I think it's games in that way are one element of many, which is to say that I don't believe that subset of gamers. I think if they look at screenshots from a game and react about the appearance of the main character like that, well, they're already kind of sexist before they were even exposed to the game, right? They already had a very internalized worldview.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure how the translation is made. I just don't want to make games or any particular medium in general the center.
Yeah.
I think it's a constellation of things.
I see.
So games can add to the pile and cement your worldviews or challenge them, just like a good novel will.
So, in that sense, it is more of the conversation that you have with media, more than just media itself imposing on you that how you should see and believe and all of that.
Yeah, it's a big cultural network. And I don't believe video game makers necessarily make games to be didactic and to make you see the world a different way. Some do, that's for sure, and whether that's bad or not depends on the execution and the intent. But by and large, a lot of people are trying to tell stories.
Yeah.
And the fact that they have an impact and will reflect certain values is, again, just like the politics, it's built in. It's the signs we process.
A very Foucauldian thing, in a way.
I hate that.
Yeah, but it is part of, I guess, the cultural apparatus.
Yeah.
That sort of very low-key teaches us, sometimes not so low-key, teaches us how we should be to fit into this specific society.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are... there's an interesting interplay there, too, with the idea, the Foucauldian idea of punishment and how games reward you or punish you for certain behaviors.
Yeah.
And certain mechanics, where, very often it can reflect bigger social things.
Yeah, now that you mention it, the game I'm playing now, Astral Chain, I noticed that it has a very interesting thing going on, where if you pick up litter from, like, empty cans from the city and toss them to the garbage, you get points. And if you accidentally knock over some boxes that are stacked in a corner, you lose some points. Or if you accidentally bump into someone too hard, you lose some points. So this game is made by a Japanese company, and Japanese are sort of fairly known for adhering to order, a very specific kind of order that requires cleanliness and sort of distance, even within close quarters. So I guess that would be a sort of recreation of that kind of cultural view, just in a game.
Yeah, I'm wary about like having our Western views sort of look at Japanese culture that way,
mm-hmm.
because I know there have also been cases of subversion when it comes to that. But
yeah,
I definitely see what you mean. And yeah, I think that's true. I think that that mechanic, like that you pick up litter and you get rewarded for it, it's definitely a value,
mm-hmm.
right? A social or cultural value that's embedded in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. That reflects it. It's just like games that, you know, sort of punish you for not paying your bills on time if you're playing a management game,
mm-hmm.
or the way you would run a government in something like SimCity.
Yeah.
Or again, to return to Call of Duty, that actually it's good to kill people during a level,
yeah.
because they're your enemies.
Yeah.
And that's what they are.
Yeah.
All of that is loaded with meaning.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Now, as a gamer and narrative designer with all this as a background, is there a way to maybe subvert hegemonic discourse through video games, either through creation as a narrative designer or a part of a development team, or as a player? I mean, I know there are things like mods, but I do not know if that would count as a subversion. And maybe we should say what mods are.
Yeah, mods are just game modifications. So when you play, let's say, a role-playing game, you can download, like Skyrim is a very popular example, you can download mods that add new quests or alter the graphics,
mm-hmm.
or add new weapons, and so on. So their mod stands for modification.
Mm-hmm.
And they're generally, almost always, player-made or community-made.
Yeah.
Okay, before getting to that, I think I would... Look, there are so many conversations about whether art can be revolutionary,
mm-hmm.
or contribute to any sort of subversive effort.
Yeah.
I think it can, I just don't think we can map it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I default back to are... changes in material practices.
Mm-hmm.
So who makes games, who gets to tell stories, who has a voice,
mm-hmm.
in the hegemonic discourse. For example, I would invite anyone listening to this to think of a game studio primarily staffed or telling indigenous stories.
Yeah.
Wherever those indigenous communities may be from. You're probably going to struggle
with finding that. Yeah, it would probably have to be an indie, definitely not a AAA.
Yeah, and can you think of stories that came out of, you know, North or South African countries? They're out there, you know, there are thriving games cultures all over the world, and there have been for a long time, and play has been a part of cultures everywhere. So when I think about the hegemonic discourse, I think about how we can have more voices, different voices,
mm-hmm.
and not always the same ones necessarily, telling stories. After that, whether the content of a game can itself subvert, I think so. It's just very hard to map. I guess if you make a game like Battletech,
mm-hmm.
with big giant robots, and you create your pilot at the start, and you're not asked if you're a man or a woman, you're just asked for your pronouns,
mm-hmm.
and some gamers get mad about it, you've done your bit for subversion.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Yeah, you definitely created some ripples here.
Yeah. And I would argue, because one of the games that you've worked in is Neurocracy, and I recall that you made an entry about Palestine and Palestine being free, Would you say that that is in itself a subversive action, seeing that the issues, many issues, and all the violence going on right now in the Palestine, well, in all of Palestine, I can't even say the border because it moves so much.
Yep. I hope it is subversive. I think it is. Well, look, it's very personal and it's very emotional in a general sense for me, because when it comes to that particular topic, we're seeing very much a closing down of what is acceptable to say or not. And so, yeah, it's personal for me in the sense that I think it's important to try and give what I see as a glimmer of hope and some form of voice for the oppressed. But also, yeah, I think it's subversive in the sense that, one, I don't see many games talking about Palestine.
No.
In general. And two, I don't see games taking that stand where you say, hey, hopefully this group of marginalized people will overthrow oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And to be clear, Neurocracy also has places where oppression won. There's a state in the U.S. that has seceded from the United States and is now an independent, very far-right ethno-nationalist nation.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think even that is subversive.
Yeah.
Right? Even though it depicts the quote-unquote, not even quote-unquote, the bad guys.
The bad guys winning. Yeah, if you're, you know, I would say...
If fascists won, then those are bad guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in this case, they won over that state.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's not about just championing what you see as morally right.
Mm-hmm.
It's just setting a frame for... And taking a stand, I think, is more important than anything, right? Because none of us wrote the fascists as like, hey, we love them.
Yeah.
It's quite the opposite.
It's more like that really known Onion article that has been used over and over again about country that has seen this happen over and over again get surprised when it happens again.
Absolutely, yeah. And that Onion piece is, yeah, that's about mass shootings, right?
Yeah.
That is subversion. That is very much, it's satire. It's bitterly sarcastic about what's going on. And I hope there's power in that. I think there's nothing to do but create that kind of art and hope that it radiates, and at the same time try to create the material conditions to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, you know, maybe we get to live in a better world. I don't know. Yeah. One hopes.
So I guess we could see media as a sort of embodied theory that does not... It's empty unless it has the praxis coming from the studios, from the people working in those studios, from everyone, basically. Well, at least as many people as possible engaging with those studios to see that, hey, this studio is saying that this is, through their games, political games, saying maybe indigenous people should be heard. It's nothing and it's empty unless they're actually hiring indigenous people to be part of those stories.
I think the saying that I hear every so often is representation will not save us. And so, yeah, I would argue so, because I don't know that it's empty. I think it's dangerous is maybe a better way to put it. I don't think it can ever... Or if you mean in the sense of like it's an empty gesture?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. And that there's a danger in that. Because, look, I don't think a studio with 20 designers, none of whom are indigenous, should tell the stories of indigenous people.
You have a good point, yeah.
So they may create something, and they may hire consultants and like, you know, subject matter experts and try to limit the damage here, but it's they're mimicking other voices.
Yeah.
And I understand you always do that, inevitably. I am not arguing that you can't write outside of your own culture or whatever you identify as. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the power structures are very real, and that there are degrees to which you will never be able to tell the story of others. And that's where you do bring them in. So, yeah, material changes.
Okay. And I think that is all the questions we have for today. Thank you so much for agreeing to this interview.
Thanks for asking me to do this interview.
Okay. Thanks to everyone listening. And if you're interested in subjects about data and, yes, culture, digital culture and identification, please be sure to check out Coffee Over Data blog and just Google it, because it has a really weird URL since we're part of the Malmö University project thing going on. Thanks, everyone. Bye.